This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, revisiting the conflict in Yemen and its regional ramifications. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. An airstrike by a U.S.-backed, Saudi-led coalition killed more than 140 people and injured hundreds more at a funeral last week in Yemen's capital, Sana'a, thrusting the conflict back into the headlines. The funeral was being held for the father of the interior minister, who was appointed by the Houthi-led administration and is a key ally of former Yemeni president Ali Abdullah Saleh. Former President Saleh was ousted in the aftermath of Yemen's popular revolt in 2011, inspired by the Arab Spring protests, but later aligned himself with the Houthis, an indigenous Shiite group with ties to Iran. Yemen's conflict pits an alliance between the Houthi rebels and Saleh's loyalists against President Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi, who is backed by Saudi Arabia, the United States, and their allies. In February 2015, the Houthis seized Sana'a and forced President Hadi southward. That prompted Saudi Arabia to enter the war in March 2015 and attempt to restore Hadi to power. As many as 10,000 people, mostly civilians, have been killed, according to the United Nations. Millions more are suffering from hunger, illness, and displacement. The United States is facing growing criticism for supporting Saudi Arabia's air campaign. A U.S. Navy destroyer off the coast of Yemen came under a ballistic missile attack in the Red Sea, allegedly by Houthi rebels who are thought to be backed by Iran. In response, the U.S. military said it struck three radar sites in Yemen. Well, with us to discuss the escalating violence in Yemen and to what extent the conflict is increasingly morphing into a proxy battle between regional rivals, Iran and Saudi Arabia, are Graham Bannerman. He's a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute. That's a think tank here in Washington. Previously, Graham Bannerman served as a staffer for the Middle East and South Asia on the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee and as a Middle East analyst for the U.S. State Department. And Hussein Ibish, he's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington and former senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine. He's also a weekly columnist for The National, and that's a premier news source in the United Arab Emirates. He also writes a weekly column for The New York Times. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, Graham Bannerman, let me begin with you. A very complicated conflict. Take us back to the origins of the conflict. How and why has it morphed into this non-ending conflict that seems to defy political solution so far?
Well, I think the level of interest of the two parties is quite different. Because of the nature of Yemen, there are three countries in the Arab world who are defined by minorities, and they are very important to the identity of these countries. One is Lebanon with the Christian minority, the other is Oman with the Ibadi minority, and Yemen by the Zaydi group. From 897 till 2012, the leader of Yemen was a Zaydi. Under Saudi influence in 2012, an agreement was reached for the temporary put in position al-Hadi, who is a Sunni for the first time. Then there was an extension of al-Hadi for longer than that, and I think that anybody who did not think there was going to be a problem when you break the leadership of one group in the country for over a millennium was mistaken. Clearly, the people who are fighting in Yemen in the north against the Saudis are Zaydi / Yemeni nationalists who are fighting for their very existence in their country.
And we're talking about the Houthi.
Well, it gets a little more complicated. The Houthis were a subgroup of the Zaydis who were in the northern part of Yemen, who were in constant rebellion against the central government, which was President Saleh. But what happened was they were both Zaydis. But when you replaced the Zaydi leadership with a Sunni leadership, it forced the two sides together. So it's no longer just a Houthi, which was this one subgroup. It was the Zaydi community almost as a whole, plus other Yemenis who were Yemeni nationalists who did not want to be overrun by the Saudis. So you have a combination of forces here.
All right. Well, turning to you, Hussein Ibish, to unpack this conflict, Graham Bannerman emphasized the sectarian nature of it. We know that Yemenis rose up in the midst of the Arab Spring wanting to have greater freedom. Okay, Saleh left under duress, obviously.
Yeah.
And now we have this situation.
Well, there
today.
Was an agreement, a Saudi brokered agreement, whereby he voluntarily surrendered power and a new government led by Hadi emerged. But Saleh was not satisfied with that arrangement whatsoever. And really, I think he never accepted the loss of power. And the idea that his sons and the rest of his family would be kind of frozen out of the Yemeni political system was absolutely unacceptable to him. He made common cause with the Houthis. And essentially what you had in 2015, which is the proximate cause of the intervention and the war, was the overrunning of Sana'a by the Houthis and Saleh forces, and basically what amounts to a coup that overthrew the Hadi government. So the sort of legal underpinning of the war and the Saudi-led intervention is UN Security Council Resolution 2216, which calls for the restoration of the Hadi government, the withdrawal of the Houthis from the areas and their allies, the areas that they had conquered during the proximate fighting, and kind of generally a pulling back to the status quo ante.
But they clearly didn't pull back.
No, not at all. And that's why the fighting has gone on, because essentially there is an effort on the part of Saudi Arabia and its allies to enforce, essentially, the terms of that resolution, but they haven't been able to do that, especially in the north. In the south, things have gone a little differently.
Back to you, Graham Bannerman. Now that we've established sort of the roots of the conflict, now let's go to this terrible attack on the funeral, this attack that killed so many people. Saudi Arabia is now looking into how this happened. Do you think the Saudis made a mistake, or perhaps it might have been on purpose because this was the funeral of a Houthi general? What are your thoughts, and to what extent is the United States to some extent implicated because it does support this Saudi-led coalition?
A single incident does not define a overall strategy that the Saudis have. That is what was coming under question. There was deep questioning among the allies. Many countries have allied themselves with Saudi Arabia in Yemen, not so much because they support what the Saudis are doing in Yemen, but they support Saudi Arabia and want to help their security. There has been increasingly discomfort among some of the allies of Saudi Arabia,
such as
United States, Great Britain, Egypt, and others, over what is going on in Yemen, because they see it as this one-sided bashing of the Yemenis by the Saudis with no positive results coming out of it. So what was happening all before this incident, there was questioning and there was criticism in the capitals of the allies. And all this incident did was to increase that criticism of the Saudis. It created a greater problem for the Saudis to hold their coalition together. I think, in addition, the determination of the Yemenis, the Zaydis or Houthis or what do you want to call them, the forces that are against Saudi Arabia, has been much greater than intended. In addition, I think they've also been able to inflict cost on the allies that were unanticipated when the fighting began in the spring of 2015. And this has become an increasing problem for Saudi Arabia, a cost in lives, a cost in finances, and the fact that the forces in Yemen are able to strike at Saudi Arabia in the provinces nearby, yeah. The fact that they can sink ships that belong to the coalition. No one anticipated this. It's going on much longer than anyone thought would happen.
Hussein Ibish.
Yeah, I mean, I think what one of the things that's happened is that with the Saudi intervention and the way that events played out, as Graham described in his first set of comments, what you ended up with is a new kind of sectarian split in Yemen. And I think between that and the intervention by the Saudis and the Emiratis and the others, you had suddenly a real opportunity for Iran to get involved with the Houthis and their allies and start to really bedevil the Gulf Arab states and to gain a new client, if not proxy, in the Houthis. And they have done that very successfully. Now, in the process, what's happened is the Houthi capabilities have been greatly expanded. So you see that about 500 Saudis have been killed by shelling and bombing across the border by basically Houthi rockets. Recently, there was a Houthi attack that was basically aimed at Mecca and fell on Taiz, which is 50 miles south of Mecca. It was pretty close. Their ability to strike into the heart of Saudi Arabia, is expanding. And as Graham was saying, also their ability to attack and severely damage an Emirati ship in the waters off the coast of Yemen recently that had formerly been part of the U.S. Navy, and twice attack U.S. Navy ships, provoking this bombing of one of their radar sites, really shows that not only is this a stalemate on the ground, but that the Houthi capabilities are strengthening rather than being degraded, and that Iran is playing not only a bigger role in terms of strengthening the Houthis, but I think it's hard to imagine the Houthis going ahead and repeatedly attacking the U.S. Navy without Iranian permission. And therefore, Iran, I think, is kind of trying to draw the United States into this quagmire, particularly during the last days of the Obama administration, where you see, for example, in Syria, Russia and the Assad regime in Iran trying, I think, to settle things in Aleppo before Obama goes. There's a lot of military maneuvers taking place during the waning days of President Obama, just in case his successor isn't quite as reticent to flex American muscles.
Well, we'll talk more about Iran's role in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Hussein Ibish, from whom you just heard. He's a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. And Graham Bannerman. He's a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute, a think tank also based here in Washington. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal fan, John Baptista Ngatia from Katarina, Kenya. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. What did you learn or find most interesting about the show today? Let us know by sending an email or commenting on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Graham Bannerman, to talk about this conflict in Yemen and the role of Iran. To what extent are we witnessing sort of a proxy battle between Iran on the one hand and Saudi Arabia in Yemen? Hussein Ibish brought up the role of the United States. Some analysts say that the United States is sort of turning a blind eye to what Saudi Arabia is doing in Yemen, or to placate Saudi Arabia because of the Iran deal. Is there any basis for that?
No, I think the United States is an ally of Saudi Arabia. For the last 40-some years, we're in a commitment to protect Saudi Arabia against external threats. Mm-hmm. We have had an alliance with Saudi Arabia, with stresses in that alliance occur, but that relationship is very important to us, and we think it's important to Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, however, see the world somewhat differently than we do. They're engaged in what they see as a larger struggle against Iran and the Shiite regimes. We don't share all of those things, and we do not want to get dragged into this battle throughout the region. My view on Yemen is a little different. It's that the Zaydis in Yemen had little or no connection with Iran prior to the change of government. The Iranians, on the cheap, can cause a huge trouble for Saudi Arabia once the Saudis made the mistake of going in there and trying to enforce their will on the Yemeni people, who then look for the only ally around who will help them, which is the Iranians. So for a small commitment, the Iranians can create great problems for Saudi Arabia. It's like going to the boxing match and leading with your chin.
That's true, I think. I think it is a very cheap and easy way for Iran to bedevil Saudi Arabia. And I think it's just fallen into the laps of Iran. They didn't have to work for this. But they are taking, I think, a lot of advantage from it. The one thing I would say is that in terms of proxy conflict, that you've got in Yemen and Syria parallel tracks emerging where there's one step closer to direct confrontation. I mean, I would say that Saudi Arabia and Iran are closer to open conflict today than they've maybe ever been in recent decades. And they're not going to do that if they can possibly avoid it because it's too costly. But in Syria, you have actual Iranian forces on the ground fighting rebels that are partly backed by Saudi Arabia and others. And in Yemen, you have Saudi and Emirati troops and others fighting Houthis who are supported by Iran. So you've got the forces of each country, one in Syria and one in Yemen, fighting militias that are backed by the other side. And this is one step closer to direct confrontation than we've ever seen before that.
But here's a question for you, Hussein Ibish. Do you think part of the rationale for Saudi Arabia trying to shore up Yemen and then going in militarily in March of 2015? Did that have something to do with their ire at the United States for negotiating this Iran deal?
No.
Behind their backs or for the U.S. inaction in Syria? No.
No, it has to do with their analysis of the trajectory of where the strategic balance of power in the region is going and the strengthening of Iran, the emergence of Iran as an ascendant power in the region. I agree with Graham that before that intervention, the Houthi-Iranian connection was slight, but it was still too much for Saudi Arabia to see Iran expanding into Syria, into Iraq, etc. And with the meltdown of the Iraqi state and the rise of Iran as a regional power and potentially ultimately a nuclear power, and finding their presence not just in places like Iraq and Lebanon and Syria, but now also in Yemen, or even the rise of the Houthis when they were distantly connected to Iran, was still one step too far for the Saudis. And I think they felt that Yemen was in their backyard. The notion that Iran was acquiring another asset in their soft underbelly, as well as protecting, successfully defending their strategic asset in Syria, which, if you think in sectarian terms, is traditionally a Sunni-dominated society, but is ruled by quasi-Shiite Alawites, the Assad regime, this was what drove them. I think where the Iranian nuclear deal and also the dispute between the United States and Saudi Arabia over Syria, where the Syrians really want the Americans to be much more involved. They want the Americans to be involved in some kind of effort to overthrow the Assad regime, to say this is too much and we're going to look for a post-Assad future. And they're not seeing that from the United States. What they're seeing is the United States moving, from their point of view, closer and closer to the Russian position and an acquiescence that, okay, Assad can stay and that ISIL is really the problem in Syria. So from their point of view, I think it's, in a sense, the United States has been willing to go along uncomfortably, unhappily, with the Saudi policies in Yemen in a way to kind of placate the Saudis and dampen their ire over the nuclear deal, over the Syria policies, etc., which they can't do anything about. And one way of sort of reassuring them has been to say, we're not convinced about what you're doing in Yemen, but we're going to support you anyway. So you don't like our Syria policy and our Iran policy, fine. We don't like your Yemen policy, but we're going to support each other because that's what friends do. That's sort of the weird calculus that's been going on. It doesn't really make any sense.
Indeed. And so here we are, Graham Bannerman. Now, where do we go from here? What are the possibilities of some kind of a diplomatic solution? This can't really continue the way it's going, with so many lives being lost and Saudi Arabia's reputation also being tarnished, as well as the United States.
I'm surprised you're so optimistic to say it can't continue. Yeah. Any one of us who lived through the Lebanon Civil War that went on for 15 years until everybody was too weak and couldn't continue will tell you that never underestimate the capacity of people in the region to inflict pain on their opponents. The irony here is, in Syria, the Saudis are supporting the group who are trying to overthrow the internationally recognized government.
Wait just a minute. The Friends of Syria technically recognize the opposition to Bashar al-Assad. I mean, he is technically the official government, but he is basically
has lost his legitimacy.
You know, basically committing genocide on his own people.
I mean, there's lots of bad things they say about him. I agree with you. But the point is, in Yemen, I think no one believes Hadi has the support of the people of Yemen under any basic definition of popular support.
It depends on which
support.
People.
You know, but the majority of people of Yemen. Hadi was always a weak reed in which to build your case on.
Okay, that's true.
And it also depends on how you define Yemen, because what you've had is this increasing identity change within the region over the last 40 years, where your people are no longer identifying with their nation states.
Yeah.
You're identifying with your confessional states or your village or your group or your community or family. And so what happens in Yemen, the merger in the early 90s between North and South Yemen brought into the Yemen state all of the Hadramaut and these areas to the south that were all Sunnis and changed the balance of forces.
Yeah.
While the dominant political force was in the north, which were the Zaydis. And therefore, you cannot solve these problems unless you recognize that dichotomy, and we're nowhere close to getting to recognizing that problem.
So Hussein Ebbers, we're nowhere close? I mean, to what extent the new leadership in Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, do you think he has a role in maybe this aggressive move vis-a-vis Yemen?
Yeah. Well, it's complicated. I mean, he as defense minister, the deputy crown prince, the young Mohammed bin Salman, he's defense minister, among other things, and he's kind of been personally associated. He's associated himself personally with this conflict, which is turning into a stalemate and may well become a quagmire for Saudi Arabia. And so I think it's important for him that this is ultimately seen as something other than a failure. And so that's, in the end, maybe one of the things that can help us get to a settlement. On the other hand, the Houthis and their allies haven't had any incentive to help the Saudis extricate themselves. And I think that you can see from their attitude towards ceasefires, which was very provocative, and their general conduct in the Kuwait talks. The UN was moderating or negotiating peace talks in Kuwait between the Yemeni factions that collapsed a couple months ago. I think you can see from those, the way they went, that the Saudis are increasingly interested in a political arrangement, but that the other side doesn't have any incentive to grant them that escape because they've gotten themselves into a trap here. In the end, I think there has to be some kind of an agreement. But I agree with Graham, things can always get worse and conflicts can always continue. And so there isn't going to be an out in the near term, I don't think, because too many of the parties involved have incentives to continue under different circumstances, one of which will appertain at any given moment. So, for example, as the talks broke down, or rather, I would say that the Houthis and their allies were very provocative in arranging essentially for the talks to break down. Since then, the Saudis escalated the conflict, and now the Houthi side has escalated in another way, first of all, by attacking deep in Saudi Arabia and internationalizing by attacking the U.S. Navy. So there's this downward spiral that's very difficult.
It's a downward spiral. Graham Bannerman, as we close to talk about what the United States can or should do, it has been directly attacked by the Houthis.
So I think you have to put this into context. Okay. What happened was the UAE has been a strong supporter. The United States has been a strong supporter of Saudi Arabia. Last month, Houthis struck the ship of the UAE, mm-hmm. and they also, we haven't got much attention, is they also crossed the Red Sea mm-hmm. and attacked the UAE forces at a harbor in Asab in Eritrea, and also landed forces that attacked an airbase used by the UAE. Mm-hmm. So it was internationalized. The right. ships that were attacked by the United States were sent into that region following the attack on mm-hmm. the UAE ship. And the chances of the Yemeni forces ever hitting a rocket on an American ship are zero. So therefore, the United States finds itself as, do we want to get further involved? And that is a debate here. There are those in Washington mm-hmm. who are advocating the United States should try to use this as an excuse to force the Houthi Saleh forces off the coast of Yemen. They fail to see, those advocates, in my view, that Hodeidah is a city of 600,000 people. It's the second largest city in the country. Mm. Do we really want to get into that? I think it's in the American interest to try to encourage our allies in the Emirates and in Saudi Arabia to negotiate some solution to this problem rather than trying to impose it on the people in the northern part of Yemen.
Yeah, promoting an agreement is the right policy, I think. I think that's true. The Iranians have also, just in terms of escalation, Iran has now dispatched major warships, insofar as they have them, to the waters of Bab al-Mandab and where all this stuff has been taking place. So it is escalating, and the wisest policy for the United States is to push for a ceasefire. I mean, I think a political resolution comes in time, but I think we really, the sine qua non of everything positive is a ceasefire that can, among many other things, bring humanitarian aid in, because many parts of Yemen are on the brink of famine and things are going very badly, especially in parts of the north. I think in the south, the UAE-led effort has gone much better and, in fact, has pivoted to a counterinsurgency campaign against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which was thriving in the midst of this war. And that's something that I think the United States can embrace wholeheartedly. A campaign against AQAP is a good and necessary thing. And I think we can work very closely with the Emiratis on that, and should.
And do you think the United States has sufficient leverage over Saudi Arabia at this point?
No. To force them to agree to something they don't want? No, absolutely not. But what we can do is help to incentivize all the different parties to behave more reasonably. And, you know, it's not something where we can snap our fingers or even have a decisive impact, but we can be helpful.
I'm afraid on that note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Graham Bannerman. He's non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute, and Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wagner Roberts. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
On this